tired of spills and stains on your sofa? Wash away your worries with Anabe. Anabe is the only machine washable sofa inside and out where designer quality meets budget-friendly prices. That's right, sofas start at just $699. Enjoy a no-risk experience with pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and changeable slip covers made with performance fabric. Experience cloud-like comfort with high-resilience foam that's hypoallergenic and never needs fluffing. The sturdy steel frame ensures longevity, and the modular pieces can be rearranged anytime. Shop washablesofas.com for early Black Friday savings, up to 60% off site-wide, backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not absolutely in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping or restocking fees. Every penny back. Upgrade now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.
Good evening. You are listening to Love Sport. This is the Manchester City Fan Show. Joining me, as ever, Nigel Rothman from the Man City Show podcast. He is cutting a strong figure today, aren't you, Nigel?
Stiff upper lip and all that jazz. It's we've lost a football match, and it's headline news around the world.
Which I guess we can flip into a positive, because when you lose a game and it's headline news, that must mean that you are doing something right. Of course, we are referring to the 2-0 defeat at the Etihad by Wolves this weekend. A first win for Wolves in the top flight since 1979 at Manchester City. Of course, they had one prior to that. I think it's been 20 years since they'd beaten City on their own patch. But in terms of it being the top flight, a first win for Wolves. Nigel, you were at the game. Let's just do a quick dissection.
Yeah, well, we heard that Mendy was injured just before the game. I don't think he's played more than two games.
No, nope.
That's what a statistic that is. Anyway, so we had to rejiggle at the back, which we've kind of few problems already. You might remember with Laporte out injured and Stones out injured, so we had emergency sort of things going on at the back the whole time. And I have to say, can I just start off by giving Wolves credit, because there's no question they set up well. They had a solid five at the back and three really close in front, working really hard. And it's difficult when you've then not got Kevin De Bruyne. Who has been magnificent this year, not playing. That has an impact as well. And then you got Leroy Sané out injured. Now, this is a squad I know that spent millions of pounds on the best talent on the planet. But when you've got Kevin De Bruyne not playing, Mendy not playing, Laporte not playing, Stones not playing, Sané not available, it is going to have an impact. And teams are beginning to understand how City play. And I have to say, full credit to Wolves. That having been said, I think it was potentially, I'm going to stick my neck out, probably the worst performance that I've seen under Pep Guardiola.
Really?
Yeah, I think it was, because at the back we were inept. I think Otamendi had one of his worst games. He was poor. I think in midfield we were laboured, and up front we had a couple of shots on target. So I mean, you put all that together, and it was a poor performance. Yeah, it was. And it wasn't a surprise. They hit us on the break. They played the perfect game and probably got what they deserved.
I'm glad you've come out with that, Nigel, because I listened to what Ilkay Gundogan had to say after the game, and he was very quick to say that City have dropped points this season not because the opponent was better, but because of mistakes that City are making. I'm not sure I entirely agree with that one, especially from this weekend.
No, I think we're not firing brilliantly. You look at our goal difference, and we're scoring at will, yeah. And we got a fantastic goal difference. But you look at I'm sure we'll come on to the European game and touch on that sort of briefly. We had about 437 chances there and scored twice, one of them in the 95th minute. So I think there are issues potentially. And why we're lobbing balls into Aguero, who's 4'7", and they've got defenders are all 6'9". It just doesn't make any sense. So there was something that did not gel. It didn't work. I think we were under par. And I think at the back we are looking very vulnerable.
Yeah, indeed. Just before we get on to the defence, actually, you mentioned Sergio Aguero there. This is a guy who scored 8 goals in 6 games to start the season. We know that Aguero is quality. However, He was dropped to the bench. I'm not going to say dropped, but he was left on the bench for that game against Everton, which he won. But since scoring those 8 goals in 6 games as a striker, you want to continue playing. You want to continue that run of form. He's not scored since being dropped to the bench. And I'm not saying that's the only reason, but I do think that leaving him on the bench for that Everton game was a mistake.
Yeah, listen, I don't know the reasons why. Pep is going to, isn't he, rotate his squad. Sergio's not going to play in every game. I think we all question that. He's on a roll. He's going for the record. It's sort of thing that Sergio would thrive on, you would have thought. But I just couldn't understand why we were lobbing these high balls into him. We don't do that. You know, we play behind the lines, we play to feet, we move it quickly. It was laboured, it was slow. It just wasn't the City I've been used to seeing week in, week out. It was a really, really disappointing result. And listen, it's going to happen. And as a result, as we know, we're now, 8 points behind Liverpool.
8 points behind Liverpool, yes. We're certainly going to get on to that. And we've got plenty more coming up. We'll just talk a very quick preview. Stephen Allwise is going to come on from A View from a Blue. He's a City podcaster. Very much looking forward to chatting with City historian Dr. Gary James later. He has written a fantastic book about Man City women, and we're going to get onto that, of course. But just to continue this Wolves subject. Now, they tweaked Nuno Espirito Santo, who has a great record against Pep Guardiola, by the way. He brought in Vinagre and Traore as wing-backs, a change from their Europa League victory against Besiktas. And that worked, especially Traore in particular had a great game against Raheem Sterling for the duration, and then they pushed him up top, and we know what happened then.
Sure, and it's interesting, where I sit in the Colin Bell stand, reasonably high up, you have a fantastic view and you can see formations, and it was really, certainly in the second half, as I said before, they had this 5 across the back and playing very wide as well. So what that meant was we couldn't get our wingers wide at all, got no width, which of course City thrive on with most, if you say, got a back 4. So playing wide, and then this sort of 3 just tucked in front of them as well, which meant that very rarely was Raheem Sterling or Mahrez, before he was substituted, having that one-on-one situation with a defender. They didn't have that. They had cover all over the park. They worked tirelessly. They worked the socks off. And it worked. It absolutely worked.
And to be fair, losing against Wolves, who have a fantastic record against teams in the top 6, if we can call it that. We can kind of say this every week now in terms of the Premier League top 6. Is it really the top 6? When you look at it right now, the top 6 is Liverpool, City, Arsenal, Leicester, Chelsea and Crystal Palace. So whether that will change or not before the season ends, probably. But the top 6, as we used to know, and I'm not going to say loved it, but as it was, doesn't really exist anymore. However, it's only City and Liverpool have registered more Premier League points against that inverted commas top 6 than Wolves.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at that table, clearly we've only played 8 games. You know, people are getting really excited about the fact that it's all over. It's Liverpool's. I think, you know, the T-shirts are being printed all over Liverpool already, aren't they? The Premier League champions T-shirts are on sale already, I'm sure. So that's happening. But listen, it's 8 games. It's not over yet. I think, you know, we've still got to play them twice. And listen, Crystal Palace, we go there next, of course, after the international break. So that's a must-win game for City, of course. They're all must-win games now, if we're going to keep in touch. But it's interesting. You've got this top 6, as you say, but I think you talk to most people, most football fans, they say, do you know what? It is between those two, isn't it? It is between City and Liverpool.
Without a shadow of a doubt.
I don't think nothing has changed that. The fact City have lost a couple of games already. Liverpool haven't had a bad run. You know, they haven't had their bad run yet. They haven't had any injuries now yet. They could go all season and win every game and not drop a point. That will be phenomenal. And if they do that, they deserve to win the Premier League. I think there's a lot of football still to be played. You know, it could well be City have had their bad spell. We get Stones back. We get De Bruyne back. We get Mendy back. And they have a bad run. They maybe pick up a few injuries. Anything can happen. It's so early. It's not over yet by any means.
No, certainly not over. And those games against Liverpool are going to be crucial. And if you do pick up 2 victories in those 2 games, who knows what's going to happen? They are, of course, playing extremely well and seem to be getting every little drop, every little slice of luck that they could possibly get en route to what they're hoping will be a first Premier League or a first top flight title, I should say. In 31 years, it will become 2020, well, 30 years, won't it? Because they won it in 1990. But in terms of the City lineup, and you mentioned the injuries that are there at the moment, obviously Benjamin Mendy out of the side again, which is staggering, another hamstring injury. And I guess this is something that needs to be looked at in terms of whether it's something to do with Mendy's lifestyle, whether it's something to do with genetics, whether it's something to do with the staff at the club.
Well, you do have to ask that question, don't you, Matt? You sort of say, did he have Did he have injuries at Monaco? I don't remember particularly. I remember, actually, I was in Monaco for, the, for that Champions League game where we missed out on away goals. So I don't quite know what's gone wrong there, but clearly there's something. He's very active on social media, as we say. We probably don't need to go there again.
No.
And it's really, really disappointing because there's no question he's absolutely a Pep type of fullback. You know, and defensively, he's not the best, but going forward, he's one of the best in the world. And that's what Pep brought him in for. And what it meant, of course, is that Walker, who's maybe not having his best season, been dropped by England, of course.
Well, I want to get your opinion on that because he was taken off as well at the weekend, but not in the England setup. Are you surprised by this?
I'm not, actually, Matt. No, I think you can understand why Southgate's done that. He's got a very young squad. It's fair to say that Kyle Walker's in the autumn of his career, and I wasn't that surprised when to hear that he'd been left out. So it means he can concentrate at City and fight for his place. Of course, Cancelo was brought in as a like for like replacement, as a bit of competition for him, and played his home debut, of course, at the weekend and did all right first half and gave the ball away for one of the goals and. Was nobody had a good game, as I said before, but it didn't feel right with a right back having to play left back. We've already sort of got Fernandinho as a centre back when he's actually a holding midfielder, as you know. So it's all a bit sort of pieced together and just not an ideal situation that you want. I understand that Walker, and we were talking about it around us when he was taken off. I was convinced it was form, but apparently I read today that it was a Pep talked about him having a tummy bug, which was the reason he was substituted.
Did so he forget we wish to hand his homework in
we
as
wish,
well?
We wish him well with his tummy bug.
I do think, and what's staggering is that the club in a way can be in this position. I know that injuries are difficult to face and you only have to speak to Norwich City about that, but they were able to bring in £60 million worth of Joao Cancelo. You know, Bernardo Silva was left on the bench. Gabriel Jesus was left on the bench. So Cancelo coming in is a £60 million replacement. So money has been spent, and I'm not going to go back to this debate, but that's where the argument will come from. People go, well, hang on, you spent all this money and you're still moaning about injuries. You're still saying you don't have the squad enough to fill the places.
And I completely understand that argument. And yes, we have an embarrassment of riches and we spend a huge amount of money. But when you lose a player like Company and you have those four or five who would be regular first team players not in your side, it's going to affect things. It is going to impact things. It's not an ideal situation to have. And hindsight's a wonderful thing. At the time, I was asked many times about Company and would we miss him and did we need to replace him. And at the time, I was saying no. You know, we've got an embarrassment of riches as we've said in our defensive lineup with tens of millions of pounds being spent. But actually, you pick up one more injury and it has a very different complexion and it feels very different. And we're beginning to now having to compromise and play people out of position, which, of course, Pep's done throughout his whole career. He's done a fantastic job with lots of players, some of them at City, who have done fantastic jobs out of position. And I have no issue with Fernandinho at centre-back. Wouldn't be my first choice, but he's a fantastic footballer doing a good job.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens once Laporte comes back. Once those players, Kevin De Bruyne, like I said, so important in the middle of that park. We're going to move on to Champions League shortly. But before we do that, there was an image that was sort of beamed around social media and a lot of people picked up on it. A lot of people inside the ground, I imagine, at the Etihad picked up on it. But towards the end of the game against Wolves, you're 1-0 down, fighting to equaliser, maybe even grab a winner if you'd got an equaliser. And there was about 5-10 minutes left of the game and there were a lot of empty seats. Now, you were at the ground yourself. What was the reaction to this?
Well, I think it's a bit of a modern football problem, to be honest, Matt. I don't think City are the only team who suffer from this. But it's something that I have noticed. You may not know this, but around the Etihad, it's not the easiest place to get away from, like many football grounds. So you do have a percentage of fans who will leave the ground early. I think you've got kind of a core, I don't know, 35,000 fans, hard core fans who will never leave in any situation. I sort of count myself in that group. Whatever the situation, I'm going to stay behind. And I applauded the team off at the weekend because that's what I do. I'll never boo them. I'm never going to be someone who's going to slag them off. So you do have that hardcore number of fans. unfortunately, there are many, many other fans who make up those numbers nowadays. You know, there's the visitors, the tourists, the less hardcore fans. There's a family stand at one end where there's a lot of kids, obviously, understandably, and maybe they need to be got away quickly and so on. There's lots of reasons for it. I don't like it because at the end of the day, the last 5 minutes can be, we know whether it... whether it's Dickoff, whether it's Aguero, I mean, there's lots of examples, whether it's Sterling in the Champions League, albeit it was chalked off. There's so many things happen in a game that goes for more than 90 minutes. I don't quite understand why people do leave. Yeah, they want to get away and miss the traffic, but if you miss an Aguero moment, you'd never forgive yourself. So, but I don't think City are the only ones who suffer from this, Matt. I think you do see that around the grounds.
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt, and it was something that we saw, especially when Arsenal first moved to the Emirates, real problems with fans leaving the ground. And I think there was even a news report, I remember, in one instance where there were fans celebrating literally by the train station because they could hear the eruption as Thierry Henry scored like a last minute winner against a certain team. So yes, difficulties all over the country regarding this, but I guess it's one of those compromises of modern football. The money that comes into the club is a lot of it made through tourists, through corporates, through families.
Exactly. And I'm trying to think back, you know, to the early days when I used to go to Main Road, as it was, of course, whether it was the same. And I don't know if it was. Maybe it was. The memory plays wonderful things. I don't quite remember it being quite as bad. I have to say, when the second goal went in, it emptied pretty quickly. It was pretty sharp.
And yeah, you can accept that one. This is the Manchester City Fan Show on Love Sport. Plenty more coming up.
Life gets messy. Spills, stains, and kid chaos. But with Anabay, cleaning up is easy. Our sofas are fully machine washable, inside and out, so you never have to stress about messes again. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, that means fewer stains and more peace of mind. Designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly. Perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Get early access to Black Friday pricing right now. Sofas start at just $699. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Love Sport. You are listening to Love Sport and the Manchester City Fan Show on Love Sport. Me, Matt Beadle, here with Nigel Rothbaum from the Man City Show podcast. If you want to join the debate, it's very easy to do so. It's simple. Just so easy. Just pick up the phone, 0208 7020 558. Or you can WhatsApp us on that number as well, or tweet us even at Love Sport Radio. We are reflecting on that defeat to Wolves at the weekend. It can't always be nice and rosy on the Man City Fan Show here on Love Sport. And we have to say that it's now 5 points dropped, Nigel, by City in their opening four games of the home season. Home games of the season, I should say, which is quite staggering when you consider it was three all of last season and seven the year before that in total. But 5-4 already this season.
Sure, it's not been a great start. You know, you sort of come out from the Watford game where we scored eight and you think, you know, we're back on track and we're still playing great football. But you think of the previous two seasons, you know, the Centurions, and then despite an amazing season from Liverpool getting 97, 98 points, thinking they've got to win the title, they didn't. We pipped them, having a fantastic run towards the end of the season to pip them at the post. It's if you look at the sort of standard that City have set and the standard that Pep has set, it's been a disappointing start. It's not all over, as I said before, and still a lot of football to be played. But sure, it's compared to where we've been, it's not been a great start.
Indeed, still a lot of football to play, of course. We are going to continue this Wolves discussion now. And we've got Stephen Allwise from A View from a Blue on the line. How are you doing, Stephen?
Yeah, good, thanks. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. Great to have you on. We've talked a lot about the Wolves game. I have to say, something I didn't touch on was at one point, Wolves had 11 players behind the ball. So, you know, they did go with some form of attacking intent, but they were well aware of the threat that City posed as well. You had plenty of chances, didn't you, Stephen?
Yeah, well, I mean, Wolves played really well, to be fair. They defended very solidly. You know, they've got three huge centre-backs and they will have been thrilled, I'm sure, to see us just floating aimless long balls into Aguero. But yeah, they stopped us playing, and then, you know, they had their fair share of chances on the break as well. We needed Edison in the first half to keep us in it. And yeah, once they moved Traore further forward in the second half, having played wing back earlier on, you know, he's as quick as anyone in the league. So look, he made us pay late on, but they, I thought, given, you know, how they played in the Europa League just a couple of days previously, and we should have been a lot fresher than them, I thought they fully deserved their win. They played really well.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of the players that were playing and the errors, and we've already discussed that at length, I suppose, and the injuries that are with the club at the moment, another player I want to touch on is Rodri, a player that came in from Atletico Madrid. He was highlighted on Match of the Day too. And listen, we're not going to take Martin Keown's view as gospel here, but he said he was worried. He was concerned about Rodri in the middle of the park. Do you hold that view, or do you see that he's done well since he's joined the club?
I think he's settled in very well. It's he had a poor game against Wolves. It was pretty clear to see that. But it's a thankless task trying to replace Fernandinho, and he's probably harshly judged by some because Fernandinho for so long has been so good in that holding midfield role. Rodri's a different type of player, a bit taller, more physical, gets stuck in, wins his headers. And to be fair, over the first couple of months, he's settled in well. He does win a lot of loose balls. But I think his passing slightly more limited than Fernandinho. He doesn't seem to have that turn of pace or cover maybe as much ground. And therefore, I think our defence does look slightly more vulnerable at the moment with him in there. That's not to say that he's not going to improve in time, because, you know, Pep is an incredibly demanding coach, and Rodri has, as I said, settled in fairly well early on. But with him having a poor game against Wolves, and having Gundogan next to him, who was also one of his off days, you know, we just looked quite leggy and quite insipid in midfield, and Wolves made us pay.
Can I talk about the defence, Stephen, as well with you? Because we know about, obviously, the injuries to Laporte and Stones, albeit one's coming back fairly soon, we hope. And then, obviously, Mendy is out as well. And Otamendi had a very poor game. What's the answer, do you think, in terms of, say, the Palace game? Do you think Pep should try one of the youngsters, maybe try Garcia in there, or just persevere with what we've got? What are your thoughts at the back there? Because that's, I think, where we're looking so vulnerable at the moment.
Yeah, we are. It's one of these, when Otamendi has a bad game, he's absolutely awful. And unfortunately, he had a bad game against Wolves when he spent half the match on his backside. And he had a really poor game against Norwich as well, and was culpable for goals there. But, you know, he's still, as much as Eric Garcia is impressed in the odd Carabao Cup chance that he's been given, you know, Palace away is a very tricky place to go. And do you really want to throw him in against someone like Zaha, or they might play Benteke, who's obviously strong in the air, and Garcia's quite small for a centre-back? I think it'd be a risk to go with, you know, Garcia ahead of Otamendi, and then you might be in the position of playing Fernandinho over Otamendi, who's an international centre-back as well. So I don't think we've got that many options. I think for home games, maybe you can throw Garcia in if we're going to have a lot more of the ball. I think really you have to hope that Stones is back fully fit after the international break, and see if you can rotate Stones with maybe Otamendi and Fernandinho on the other side. But it also needs those around them. Someone like Walker, who you were talking about before, not having his best season, you know, he needs to step up now. I was surprised that Zinchenko, who's been Mendy's replacement for so long now, wasn't in the team against Wolves. And Cancelo, who's a very attack-minded right-back, was having to play left-back. So I think Pep has been trying to almost fit square pegs into round holes, but, you know, the attacking players have got to make up for the fact that we do look slightly more vulnerable at the back at the moment.
And up front, they've not been that convincing, have they either, Stephen? Your thoughts on our sort of strike force in the last couple of games?
Yeah, it's hard for them. I think Aguero looked isolated against Wolves. Mahrez looked quite isolated as well. I think actually a lot stems from the midfield three. And if David Silva's at his best, we know from watching City so often, the amount of times he plays that ball in between the fullback and the defender for the left winger to run onto, or the way he can knit attack together, or if Bernardo's in the middle, he can run with the ball and he can pick the wingers out. I think Gundogan dropped quite deep against Wolves and he had a really poor game, looked, you know, lacking in confidence on the ball. So, you know, it's a tricky one because I think Pep is, in a sense, so worried about the defence and trying to protect them given the makeshift centre-back pairing that we just look as if we've lost that slight spark in attack, which, you know, it's not that long since we scored five in the opening 15 minutes against Watford or could have scored five in the opening 15 against Dinamo Zagreb. So, yeah, part of me thinks it was just an off day against Wolves, but I think there is an issue there that needs looking at.
Yeah, I think you're right, Stephen, because when you look at the two games in particular, you mentioned the Watford game, clinical as ever, but if you take the game against Dinamo Zagreb and the game against Wolves, that's 38 shots in total from City, but just 8 on target. And so there is a concern there, I suppose, that clinical nature that we know City have had, especially under Pep Guardiola in the past couple of years, is maybe, just maybe waning slightly. Another player I want to touch on who was clinical, of course, in that Champions League victory over Dinamo Zagreb was Phil Foden. Now, he came on and scored. This is a guy that so many people are calling a future England star. Raheem Sterling came out and said that he wanted Phil Foden in the England setup. It was interesting what Pep Guardiola said afterwards, because he said, you know, I feel sorry for Phil Foden. And I know that he was saying it in a jokey kind of way, but he said he deserves more minutes. He was an unused sub against Wolves. He turns 20 this season. How much longer do you think we're going to have to wait until he actually gets his chance in the Premier League?
I wouldn't have thought, given the performance against Wolves, that it will be too long now. I think Pep is doing the right thing to manage him carefully. And he's talking him up in the press and he's saying how well he's training. But he's being careful in terms of the amount of opportunities he gives Foden. And it's frustrating from the outside because looking in, you hear everyone in the game say what a brilliant talent he is, what a brilliant player, he's got all the ability in the world. And we've not had that many opportunities to see that in action on the pitch. I think as we push towards the back end of this season, he'll play a lot more. Next season, when David Silva's no longer at the club, I think he'll feature a lot more and he'll be more of that integral part of the first team. At the moment, he's very much a player that Pep thinks, you know, I'll wait till maybe we're two or three up to bring on and give him some time. But when you look at how insipid we were against Wolves or how lacking in creativity, it was almost crying out for someone like Foden with that spark and with his energy and an eye for a goal just to come on. So, yeah, on one hand, frustrating to see Pep kind of limit the amount of time he's playing, but genuinely, I believe that long term, Pep is doing the right thing for Foden and protecting him that little bit.
Nice stuff, Stephen. And 8 points adrift now, just to finish. It's not a problem, is it? There's no worry, there's no concern at the moment.
I'd rather it was 8 points now than with 3 games to go.
Yeah.
Liverpool will drop points. It's one of those weekends. They had another slice of luck in the last minute. We've played poorly, so it feels like, you know, everyone's giving up to a degree. But yeah, they'll drop points. The question is whether we can go on another one of our lengthy winning runs, which we're capable of, to catch them up. But I wouldn't rule us out just yet, Matt.
Lovely stuff. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure. Cheers.
That was Stephen Allwise from A View from a Blue. This is the Manchester City Fan Show on Love Sport. Plenty more coming up.
Love Sport.
This is Love Sport, the Manchester City Fan Show. Me, Matt Beardall, here with Nigel Rothband, as ever, from the Man City Show podcast. Remember, easy to get in touch with us at Love Sport Radio or 0208 7020 558. You can WhatsApp us on that number as well. I'm delighted to say that on the line now, we have got Gary James. Gary's been researching and writing about City for 30 years. He's been a regular contributor to City programmes since 1994, and he's now recognised as a leading expert on Mancunian football history. Numerous books about Manchester City, which I'm sure he's going to tell us all about now. Gary, how are you doing? Maybe he's not going to tell us all about it now because he's not on the line. We're going to work to get Gary on the line. But Nigel, you know Gary. You know about his books.
Yeah, listen, my bookcase is half full of Gary James books. I mean, Gary is a legend. He is the authority on all things City. He's done a number of books. He's done history books. The one he brought out recently was great. It's one of those ones that you didn't kind of start at page one and go all the way through. You kind of dipped into it and sort of different articles. So he's done loads of stuff. And of course, he's done his latest book actually is about Manchester City women. So I think we're going to spend a bit of time towards the end of the show talking to Gary about that as well.
We will indeed. Well, we're just brushing his ego at the moment. He's probably heard that. Gary, you on the line now?
I am, yeah. I heard you say about 30 years and then it just went dead. So I don't know if it's just a shock of being so long, actually, but yeah.
Well, Gary, just tell us a bit about yourself. You've been contributing to programmes since 94. You're a leading expert on Mancunian football history, as I've just said. Just give us a bit of history about how you came to be a City fan and how you came to start writing your books.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from what I would say was a typical Manchester family in the half of it was blue and half was red. So from an early age, you know, you sort of have an appreciation of both teams and what both teams contribute to Manchester. But my dad took me to Main Road first and I was a City fan and, you know, and sort of City obsessed, really. I don't know what my first game was because he took me as a baby and so on, but I do know my earliest memory was when Rodney Marsh made his debut in 72, I think it was. And I remember sitting in the Platt Lane stand behind the goal and basically Rodney Marsh was my first real hero. My dad hated him, but I absolutely, there's something about Rodney Marsh that I just loved.
For what reason, Gary, did he dislike Rodney Marsh?
He believed that Marsh cost City the title and you know, years later I'm researching the history of City, then clearly when Rodney Marsh signed for City, it did disrupt the momentum of the club, and when at one point they were looking favourites for the title and then unfortunately they missed it by a point. So, you know, I suppose from this point of view, you know, the maverick that was Rodney Marsh was the player that unsettled things. Whereas for me, all I saw was this guy who was a bit of an entertainer. I didn't appreciate the sort of team ethic, I guess, at the time. I just appreciated that this guy was something special.
And at that time, Gary, as a sort of a young fan sitting at the Platt Lane, you mustn't have had any idea that all these years later you'd be kind of the authority you are, writing these books, having the access to the club that you now have. It must be a bit of a dream come true, isn't it?
At times, it's great. But of course, we've had this roller coaster existence. And so, you know, when it's bleak. Well, it was actually funny. When City were at their worst, if you like, that's when writing and researching about the history was in some ways, I don't know if it was like taking medicine in some way, because, you know, you could sort of think back to some great, you know, great periods and great successes, whether it be, you know, the beginnings of the club, the early years of the 30s, 50s, 60s or whatever. But it absolutely gets me today is that, you know, when for the first decade, 15 years of my life, really, Manchester City were a hugely successful club. They were a major power. They were seen as one of the top four or five clubs in the country. And then it all sort of fell apart in the 80s and it got worse in the 90s. But all those people who sort of talk about City in recent years as having no history, well, for most of my life, all we had was history. We didn't really have a president. It was just about, you know, past successes. So every moment of the success we have now is success, is something that we need to enjoy and need to really, well, celebrate. I interviewed Mark Carson years ago and he said one thing you must always do is celebrate every success as if it's your first, because it could be your last. And I think that's really important, because you know City had four trophies last year. No team's ever achieved anything like that. It was an incredible season, but football being football, it could be 30 years before another trophy comes. I know it's highly unlikely, but you know, you've got to believe that, and you've got to celebrate those successes.
It's interesting you talk about Malcolm Allison, because he's one of my early heroes, as you know, the whole sort of Mercer Allison reign. I go back a little bit further than you do. And there are comparisons made between that sort of the late 60s side and the current side. Is that a fair comparison to make, or are we? I know it's always difficult to compare eras. It's just very difficult to do. But we're going to do it anyway. Your thoughts on that late 60s side and that dominated English football, of course, won everything that was going on, and the current team. How would you compare those two, Gary?
Yeah, and let's not forget that late 60s, early 70s side. At the moment, is the only Manchester City side to win a major European trophy, which they achieved before Liverpool, and it was before Barcelona had won a UEFA organised tournament as well. So, you know, that was an incredible team. It's difficult every year, though. You know, when I've done my research, I've interviewed people like, well, you can talk about the 30s, and I know your dad has talked about the 30s as well, but you talk about the 1930s and the qualities of those players, and for some, supporters that I interviewed sort of 10, 20, 30 years ago, they always talked about the 30s team as being the greatest ever, and some of those players like Peter Docherty have been the greatest ever player. So it is difficult comparing era, and I really don't think you can anymore. But what is clear is that when you have a supremely talented footballer, no matter what era they're from, if you took them out and got them used to the conditions of that time, you know, a different weight football and muddy pitches or whatever, but if you got them used to it, the supreme fantasy football would certainly hold their own in any era. I for many years, you know, Roddy Marsh, then Dennis Stewart, Dave Watson, they were my heroes, Colin Bell obviously as well. But I actually think that in the last decade, we've seen just about the greatest players of all time. And I don't say that lightly, like, you know, I'm talking about people like David Silva and obviously Vincent Kompany as captain, and now we've got Bernardo and Kevin De Bruyne as well, and Aguero, you know, incredible goal scoring talent.
It's certainly a special side. I'm going to ask you an easier one then. What about the worst side or the worst player then, Gary? What about that then? It's always easy to come up with these heroes. You must have seen some rubbish. You talked about the 80s and then the 90s, where, let's remind everybody, we were in the third tier of English football. It's hard to even contemplate that knowing where we are now. But just remind us of maybe some of the worst stuff that you've seen.
Oh, and you know, the 90s, it started with two fifth-place finishes. And we thought we were going to win the league, and we thought we were going to win the FA Cup, and then we fell away, and it ended up the worst ever period. I mean, the worst manager, without doubt, for me, is Alan Ball. That's a definite. Alan Ball, the worst manager. You can't tell me anything different, really. But in terms of player, some of those players signed around that time, and it's a bit unfair, but Lee Bradbury always sort of sticks out as one of those players that cost quite a bit of money for a period, didn't seem to deliver. Now, we may be unfair, but there's also, and this, you know, a great footballer, but for City, he was nothing. Nigel Clough, you know, and it sounds really weird saying some of these names, because some of these players are good players and players who achieve stuff elsewhere. But for whatever reason, at Manchester City, at that time, some of them just could not deliver. And so I think it was more about the leadership, it was such a bad period, but it was, again, in the entire history of the club, we're only talking 5 or 6 years. It felt an awful lot longer than that. It felt like decades and decades. But that sort of, the struggle, you know, relegation in 96 through to, well, 2002, you're talking 6 years, and we've not been out of Premier League since.
It's interesting you mentioned Nigel Clough there, because that was an era where I was really starting to notice football more. That was sort of my bread and butter. I started, you know, taking notice of football around the late 80s. So that was when I was really taking it all in. And the likes of Nigel Clough, who I'd seen at Nottingham Forest and then at Liverpool and then at City, kind of similar, I suppose, to your Steve McMahons and your David Rowcastles, who went to Man City, and almost a case of, this is going to be my last contract, or a bit of an after the Lord Mayor show. You mentioned Lee Bradbury as well. Another player that springs to mind, I think I've got this right, Cole Griffiths. A striker?
Oh, yeah.
You were sort of shopping in that pool of player, weren't you?
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, Steve McMahon, I always thought Steve McMahon delivered for City. But you're right, he was obviously towards the end of his career, but I think Steve McMahon did deliver for City. Robbie Fowler certainly did not, really. Steve McManaman did not. And there's quite a few players that... We had a bit of a mix, because we had quite a few sort of academy players coming through. Obviously, the likes of Sean Wright, Phillips, and players like that were sort of coming through. And we had players that really were sort of cast off of teams that were also. And it, what really hurt me was we were playing Manchester United, this was at the Etihad, obviously the City of Manchester Stadium then, but the same stadium, and City basically beat United. And Robbie Fowler scores, and instead of Robbie Fowler focusing on Manchester City and what he's achieving for Manchester City, he held up, I think it was five fingers to or four fingers then to the United fans to remind them that Liverpool had won at that time four European Cups. And you're playing for Manchester City, you know, in a derby match for Manchester City. It really, that's the sort of thing that, although Robbie Fowler, obviously, he did achieve a few things for City, but that really upset me and that really angered me. If you, no matter which team you play for, at whatever level, you have to represent that club, no matter what your past successes are and so on. And I think the day he did that celebration was the day I sort of turned off him completely.
Yeah, I completely agree with you there, and that goes into the whole debate about when players play for their new clubs against their old clubs and don't celebrate, and you kind of think people say, oh yeah, but he's just respecting his old club. In a sense, he's disrespecting the club that he's playing for now. Gary, it's absolutely great to talk to you. You're absolutely going to stay on the line because we're going to discuss some of the books that you've written for the club, including a new one that's out soon.
Love Sport.
This is the Manchester City Fan Show on Love Sport. Me, Matt Beadle, with Nigel Rothband from the Man City Show podcast. We are currently joined by Gary James, a Manchester City a guy who's been researching Manchester City for a hell of a long time. He's been contributing to City programme since 1994, and he's written many books, one of which is out now, not soon, as I said earlier. It's out now, Manchester City, Women and Oral History. We're going to get onto that in a moment, Gary, but just first, if you just want to give us a few details about the books you've already written.
Yeah, well, I've been 19 books now, but I suppose the ones that people tend to remember are a book called Manchester, the Greatest City, which is the kind of full history of the club. Manchester Football History, which is about all of football in Manchester, and my biography of Joe Mercer, that people often remember that, Football with a Smile. I also did a history of Main Road Stadium, on the Main Road. It's been a long journey really, but there's still lots more to research and to write about. You know, no football club or football city can be covered in just a few books, really. There's so many different angles to it.
No, absolutely. I think you're right. And this is the bread and butter for me, for football fans. We love what's happening right now. We love current football. We love watching the Premier League. We love watching live games. We love watching highlights. We love everything about football. But when you can hark back to a memory, which can be both a good memory and a bad memory. We've talked about the 80s and 90s now, but instantly it sort of sparked all of us to talk about certain players and certain moments. And there's so much to talk about when it comes to history. And you being a historian, there must be so many different angles you can take to write about the club.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've spent over the last couple of years, well, last 5 years really, most of my research, I've been into the women's team, which obviously we'll talk about in a minute, but also into the origins of football in Manchester. And it's fairly clear that the moment that football started to matter to Mancunians, really, was when City won the FA Cup in 1904. Before that, Manchester didn't really know what to do with football. Rugby was the dominant sport. It just wasn't really getting anywhere. And neither City nor United were particularly successful. But then suddenly, City had relaunched in 1894 as Manchester City, and then 10 years later, they won the FA Cup. And initially, the City Council had no idea how to celebrate this, and we didn't have any kind of homecoming parade. So what City did was decide, well, we'll publish the route that we're going to travel back with the FA Cup to Ardwick, where the ground was. And instead of going to the main obvious sites, you know, Albert Square and all the big parts of Manchester that you'd expect, they did a tour of a lot of the back streets, places that were sort of hidden away. And the reason they did this was because they knew that the working class people of Manchester lived there. And there's some incredible stories of how that homecoming parade went and what actually happened. And suddenly, within weeks, people were talking about football. Support increased. And that was the point. You know, City became Manchester's club, which, you know, has lasted all the way through. But also, that gave the sport a bit of a boost and a bit of an identity for Manchester, really. And here we are all these years later, and if you ask around the world what's Manchester famous for, they're not going to talk about cotton or the Industrial Revolution, any of that. They're going to talk about football.
Can I bring us right up to date? I mean, I was saying before that my bookcase at home is half full of your books, Gary, anyway, and I'm delighted that the new book on the women is there, signed by your good self, so thank you for that. Just help us understand a little bit. I hadn't realised that actually some games go back to the 1880s, I was reading in the book, which I'm talking about women playing the game now. I was flabbergasted by that. But actually, the formation of Manchester City is only as recently as 1988. That's a huge gap between football being played and the actual formation of the club.
Yeah, well, I mean, football for women was banned for 50 years. And, you know, I have to say to people, well, if football for men had been banned between 1921 and 71, we'd never have had Jeff Hurst, we'd never have had George Best, we'd have never had Bert Trautman, and so on, you know. And so if you imagine that in 1971, suddenly women are allowed to play football as far as the FA are concerned. There were games before that, but not on FA-approved ground. Women's football had a lot of catching up to do. So the ban was 1971, and if you think about it then, 17 years later, Manchester City creates its women's team. A lot of those players have been playing in the 70s and early 80s for various teams. And that club, when it was relaunched a few years back and changed its name from City Ladies to City Women and got its place in the Super League, unfortunately, the wider public sort of were told that this was a new club. There were many people who sort of dismissed the exploits of the women before that sort of relaunch. And that was the reason why I've done the book, really, because a lot of those women have spent an incredible amount of time making sure that club developed, survived, grew. You know, they've knocked down all sorts of walls to try and get to play football. And even some of the more recent players, like Jill Scott, were interviewed for the book, and they talked about how when they were playing in school sides, the parents of the boys that they were better than, if you like, were telling their boys to kick the girl, get that girl shouldn't be playing. And you sort of think, where we are in the 21st century, you know, men and women are equal and sort of, but clearly they're not. You know, as far as some people are concerned, there's a difference. And it really, for me, the main strength of the book really is that I've captured all these stories, and there's some incredible stories of what women went through to just simply today to kick off football.
I also realised, because of my connection with the club as well, that the funding in the early days came, of course, from football in the community in the late 70s. And, of course, a friend of this show and the podcast, Roger Reed and Ian Lees, were both involved in that. But you compare what was happening in the late 70s to now. I mean, it is unrecognisable, the sort of pitches they played on, the scrabbling around to find kit and the whole attitudes to now and today. And I'm sure we'll come on to the present day. But just help us before we do that. Just the gulf between what the women had to, or the ladies as they were then, had to put up with to what it's like today. I mean, it's unbelievable, isn't it, the difference?
The obvious thing is the kit. And City were one of the best to look after the team at that time. But the kit was basically handing down kit. So even into the 2000s, I quote Andrea Waller, who was goalkeeper in the early 2000s, and she talks about how she had to wear Peter Schmeichel's kit. And she said it was so large, you could, you know, pitch it and use it as a tent. You know, but this was what happened. You know, I mean, to be fair, it's like a funded pub team in the facilities and the way things were. You know, you had to make your own way to games. You had to pay for the privilege of playing and so on. And it's only in the last five seasons that the entire sport has become professional in England, really. And so even the current stars have gone through that experience. A lot of them, not all of them, but have gone through that experience of playing their subs, playing for the local team, washing the kit. One of the funny stories in there is that one of the players who she was a United fan and she lived near Old Trafford, and it was her turn to wash the City kit in the sort of 90s, and she took it home, she put it in the wash, she hung it out on the washing line, and then she went out. When she got back home, her mum was livid. Her mum was saying, what had happened was with a United home game that night, and all the United fans had been walking past and giving abuse. And she said, I thought we were going to put the windows through. Don't put the city kit on our washing line again. But that sort of sums up, really, that's what the women had to do. You know, they had to wash the kit, they had to do everything.
Yeah, Gary, listen, it's been great having you on Manchester City Women and Oral History by Gary James. Just before you go, where can we find the book?
Yeah, I mean, you can get it from online retailers, you know, the usual place like Amazon and so on. Also, you can get that from me if you follow me on Twitter at Gary James Writer, or facebook.com/GaryJames4, and I can point people in the right direction and so on.
Lovely stuff. Gary James, thank you for joining us.
Cheers, thanks.
Yep, a great book, Manchester City Women and Oral History by Gary James. It is incredible. It includes stats from every season since they started in 1988. A very, very comprehensive book. A lot on the Manchester Derby as well, which is quite interesting because we saw record attendances in the Women's Super League for that opening game at the Etihad just last month. And the developments in women's football we know is huge. I actually interviewed Carly Telford not so long ago, and she was talking about the kits, how she used to grow up having to wear baggy kits. And of course, the team that played in the World Cup for the first time ever, the England women's team, had a kit that was designed specifically for them. Incredible developments. We could talk about it for a lot longer. Perhaps we'll get him on again. But Nigel, we've come to the end. Thank you very much for joining us.
Great pleasure.
We will be back next week. As always, it's an international break, but plenty to talk about in the world of Man City. It is the Manchester City Fan Show on Love Sport. We'll see you then.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.